Dr. Unger is an associate professor of marine sciences at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. He is active in research, teaching, and advisory services related to environmental contaminant issues in the Chesapeake Bay. His research interests include analytical method development, including biosensors, contaminant partitioning behavior, toxicity studies to assess the effects of contaminants, and long-term fate studies to assess regulatory action. He has studied polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon contamination in the Elizabeth River, Virginia, for over 25 years, and recent research has focused on the development of antibody-based sensors for near real-time analysis of environmental contaminants. And with that, I'll turn it over to Michael to start his presentation.
Thank you, Steve. And I'd like to thank SRP for funding our research and for this opportunity to talk to everybody about application of our antibody-based biosensor and how we're using that to look at pH fate toxicity at contaminated sediment sites. What I'd like to do today is go over what exactly is a pH or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon biosensor and how do we make it. And then I'd like to review some biosensor applications where we're using this sensor to look at pH transport at contaminated sites in Elizabeth River, Virginia, and how we're using that to actually assist in restoration efforts and hopefully guide more successful restoration efforts in the future. We're also using the sensor to evaluate contaminated sediment toxicity. We've done some of that work at Baltimore Harbor in Maryland. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about some of the future work, the work we've got planned for later this summer and in future summers to apply the sensor technology. Okay, our approach is to use a monoclonal antibody against contaminants. That's the bio part of our biosensor. And the sensor portion is an electronic detection of the antibody binding to our contaminant. And that's an instrument that's been developed by Sapodyne Instruments in Boise, Idaho. That's our industry partner in this development process. The goal for our monoclonal antibodies in this research is to pick antibodies that have a unique selected specificity for our targets of interest. In the case I'm talking about today, we're using antibodies we developed that particularly have high affinity for a wide range of 3 to 5 ring pHs. And for our research looking at fate and transport of pHs, we find that this 3 to 5 ring selectivity and affinity works really well. We need an antibody that has a fast on rate. It's also been affixed with a tag for easy detection in the sensor instrument. It has a high affinity. One of our goals is to have no sample preparation, to measure directly without any concentration steps and sample prep to aid in the rapidity of analysis. So how do we make antibodies to pHs or other small targets? Well, part of the difficulty with this is the targets that we're looking at are very small molecules, and they're not immunogenic. So to make them immunogenic, we take a surrogate for our contaminant of interest and put a linker arm on that surrogate, which you can see right here. And with this linker arm, we can attach the haptin, or the target, to a large protein molecule, usually BSA or KLH. And what happens is, by attaching that to this larger protein molecule, we end up with something that's immunogenic. So we can use this as an immunogen to immunize mice. So once we have our immunogen, which is our protein with our pollutant or our haptin attached to it, we can immunize the mouse and monitor its sera over time for titer of antibodies that will bind to the contaminant of interest. Once this mouse has produced antibodies that suitable for our analysis, we then take those antibody-producing cells and we produce a hybridoma, which is a fusion of the mouse's cells with a cancer cell line. And that ends up with a cell culture of hybridoma antibody-producing cells and gives us an endless supply of antibodies in cell culture. So what this enables us to do is produce antibodies that we can use as a reagent in A lot of our research has been looking at screening of these hybridomas, and that's become an important step. When we first started this research, we thought that careful selection of the hapten could produce the antibodies that we wanted. And like usual, you can't fool Mother Nature. And what we found out is the mice produce a large repertoire of antibodies given immunization with specific haptens. So the screening process became very important. And we've done a lot of research and work on the screening of the hybridomas to select antibodies that are particularly suitable for our analytical chemistry needs.
Mike?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but a few people are having problems hearing you, so if you could move a little bit closer to the speaker, or if you're on a headset, pick up your handset. Just try to be a little bit louder. Thank you.
Okay, will do. Is this better?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. For quantitation of the monoclonal antibody binding, we used the inline sensor that was developed by Sapodyne Instruments. It features automated sample handling, precise fluidics for analyzing small quantities accurately, which is very important. And we also use a fluorescent emission detection within a flow cell here, which gives us high sensitivity. And this is looking at the fluorophore that's put onto the antibody. The selectivity is based on the antibody that we use in the instrument. One of the nice things about this technology is by changing the antibody, we can change the suite of contaminants we may want to analyze in the environmental samples. To give you a feel for exactly how this works, what we have here is a diagram of what happens in the flow cell. These are beads coated with our antigen or our contaminant that we're interested in analyzing. This is our labeled antibody. And what happens in the flow cell is we initially place a set of beads with a competing antigen within the flow cell. Then we take our sample. In this case, we're mixing it into a sample with no pHs, mixing with the antibody. This flows through the flow cell. The antibodies attach, and we measure the fluorescence. Now we're going to take a new sample. This is a sample from the environment with pHs. We put a new set of beads into the detector. We mix our sample with pHs with the antibody. Much of the antibody is bound to the pHs in solution, so less are retained in the detector. And what happens is we get a high signal when there's low pHs and a low signal when there's high pHs. So this gives us a standard curve which looks something like this, which is the opposite of most analytical instruments because this is a competitive assay. This gives us a very sensitive technique which allows us to look at very low concentrations. So in summary, this is essentially what our sensor looks like. This instrument's roughly the size of a bread box. It can be used in the lab. It's designed for lab use, or we can take it out into the field. We get very sensitive and precise analysis of pHs, 3 to 5 rings with the antibody we're using currently. We can look down to subpart per billion total pH concentrations in water samples. It's so sensitive that we can look at very small volume samples as well, just a few mils. It's got good correlation to GC-MS when we split samples and run them by GC-MS. And the antibody we're using currently has a high affinity for a wide range of pHs, which is particularly useful for looking at fate and transport of toxicity of complex mixtures we see in the environment. So with the basis of this tool, we're looking at ways we can really exploit this technology to answer very difficult to ask, very difficult to answer environmental fate and toxicity. So we have something that looks at small volume samples, 1 to 5 mils. This analysis process is fast, around 8 minutes. We can look at very low concentrations, less than a tenth of a part per billion. And the thing we have to remember, it's not GC-MS. We're not getting compound-specific analysis, but we're looking at total pHs in small volume samples. So what we're interested in doing is exploiting what it can do really well. And in particular, we found that the application of looking at sediment pore waters great application for this technology. We can look at spatial and temporal resolution to identify sources and transport mechanisms, and we can use it to evaluate toxicity at a spatial and temporal resolution that's difficult to do with standard analytical techniques. The sites that we're using in the field to use this technology is primarily in Chesapeake Bay. We're looking in southern Chesapeake Bay at the Elizabeth River. which is well known for having a wide range of pH contamination due to historical creosote spills from creosote treatment plants. One of the sites, Atlantic Wood Industries, is a Superfund site, and Randy Sturgeon, the EPA, contacted that site. A lot of our research is ongoing at Money Point, which is a voluntary sediment remediation site that's being run by the Elizabeth River Project, a nonprofit, and Joe Rieger's our contact there. The first remediation at this site, it's a phased remediation, occurs in the southern end here in 2009 and 2011. There was dredging and capping in the central site, and the north site is destined for remediation in the future as funds become available. What we found at this site is some of the areas that underwent a remediation still contain DNAPL on the surface of the sediments post-remediation of dredging and capping. So we needed better methods to understand and predict the pH transport in sediment remediation sites like this to assure the long-term success. So what we're doing with this technology is we've looked at this real-time analysis, and we can use it to map pH concentrations in sediment pore waters, and we've done this actually in the field. So what we can do is take a sediment sample, squeeze through a sediment squeezer to get a dissolved fraction, run this directly, we only need a few mils, run this directly on our biosensor in the field on a boat, and get the concentrations in the field. So we've done this at a site, and we can analyze samples from up to 30 stations and survey it in a day. We can take larger samples and bring them back to the lab, and we get good correlation of GCMS analysis back to the lab weeks later. The kind of data we can produce with this technology is shown here. This is our area that had undergone remediation in 2011 and 2012. We were mapping surface concentrations surface waters. We saw 1 to 3 micrograms per liter in the surface water. In the pore waters, we saw 50 to 450 micrograms per liter in this area that had undergone remediation. And this is the kind of data we can get in a single day at a site mapping concentrations in the field. One of the things we became interested in, since we saw elevated pore water concentrations at a remediated site, was to identify what was driving the transport of pHs in these contaminated sediments. So what we've done now is taken a drive point piezometer, which is like a small wellhead. We can push this into the sediment and sample at various depths. By opening up the screen, we can sample discrete depths, take a sample with a syringe, take a few mils of that sample, since again, we only need a small volume of sample for the biosensor. We can split that sample, look at the salinity by a refractometer, and we can look at the total pH concentrations by the biosensor. This is the kind of data we could produce with this technology. You'll see a series of sites here where we're interested in what was going on with depth in the sediments. At this particular site, we knew that there was some contaminated groundwater on shore, and that may be a transport mechanism for in the sediments. What we found at looking at these six sites is that the pH concentration on the y-axis here, and this is the depth in the sediment, on the x-axis, and the depth in the sediment on the y-axis, is that as we looked with depth, the pH concentrations increased at all our sites. So we had high concentrations with depth, lower concentrations near the surface. If you look at those same samples and look at the salinity in the samples, we found an inverse relationship between salinity and the pH concentrations at these sites. So what was happening is saline surface waters, the surface waters at this particular location tended to range between 16 and 22 parts per thousand, were mixing with more contaminated pore water at depth within the sediment. So this technology allowed us to actually look at the 3D distribution of pHs within the sediments at the site. We were interested in what was actually driving this pH transport at the site, and we were also interested in looking at transport from the sediment to the water column, because pH flux to the water column may be an important process for determining the bioavailability to water column organisms. To do this work, we used seepage meters, and these were connected with a Teflon tube to a bag. And again, because we could look at such small volume samples, we could sample these seepage meters hourly to get a feel for the flow out of the surface sediment simultaneously take those samples, run them on biosensor, and get a measure of the concentration as well as the flow. We're interested in this because at these estuarine sites, we feel that non-traditional groundwater transport mechanisms may help drive contaminant flux. Things like wave pumping may become important at these estuarine sites where we have tidal waves that could control the input and output from the sediment and the mixing within the sediment. And this is the kind of data we're able to obtain with this technology. In these graphs here, you can look at flow rate on this y-axis, and these represent the triangles you'll see in these graphs. These are four of the sites. And this is the average water height, or a measure of the tide at a given time. And what you see is we got the highest flow rate at all our sites during low tide. And at high tide, the flow rates were generally reduced. And from the pH concentrations measured by the biosensor, we were actually able to show what the pH flux was at a function of tide at these various sites. What's interesting is the pH flux was actually the highest at two of the sites that had undergone remediation. These sites are pre-remediation up here that are targeted for remediation in the future. And what's happening is during the remediation process, it's typical to cap with more coarse materials, and these more coarse materials can actually increase the advection through things like tidal pumping at the site. And that looks like exactly what's going on. So we have tidal-driven advection within the sediment, and the tidal pumping at low tide, we get flux out of the sediments. At high tide, there's input into the sediment from the water column, and that's why we see the salinity distributions we're seeing at those sites as well. We've also used this technology to look at pore water toxicity, and we're doing this work in collaboration with Lance Yonkos and students in his lab at the University of Maryland. Sharon Hartzell did this as part of her master's thesis. And we looked at Baltimore Harbor because it, like the Elizabeth River, is highly industrialized, has high concentrations of organic contaminants and metals. And previous work has shown that there's, if you look at amphipod toxicity and survival, that there's a correlation between the survival and the distribution of contaminants at some of these sites. So we decided to look at using sediment test methods like Leptochirus, a standard test species, look at an acute 10-day toxicity test of whole sediments. This is a neat test for looking at sediment toxicity because over the 10 days, the animals are not fed. They live within the sediments. They feed and live in the sediments, and after 10 days, we look at survival. With our biosensor, since we look at small volume samples, we could take an aliquot of the sediment used in the test and measure pore water with the biosensor to see how that correlated to predicting toxicity. Kind of data that we were able to produce with this experiment, and we found that the survival based on color here and the size of the circles is based on the pH concentration. That pH is in pore water and sediment were strongly correlated with toxicity. At this site where there was a large suite of contaminants, unfortunately also were nickel, chromium, and other contaminants at the site. So this agreed with the previous studies that showed that there's multiple contaminants and no clear causation because of the multiple correlations. So we were wondering if pHs were contributing to the overall toxicity of the site, at the sites. So we used a spiking experiment, and we took control sediments from the site and spiked with a suite of 18 pHs that we knew were found in the field samples, and we found data like this from that experiment. We used 19 pHs. 19 different pHs. We used a distribution that was similar to what we found at the contaminated site. And what we found was that the survival in the amphipods was not very well predicted by the total sediment pH concentrations in our experiment. But when we looked at the biosensor measurements of pHs in the pore waters, it did a pretty good job of predicting the toxicity. And like other studies that have shown previously, it's this pore water concentration that predicts the bioavailable fraction and the toxicity in the sediment. So what we found was that pore water analysis can be used to identify toxicity, and with our biosensor technology, you could potentially even do this in the field and do it in near real time. What we also found was that the concentrations in pore water in our spiking experiments were higher than the pH concentrations, giving the same amount of toxicity in the field samples, so we feel that the Baltimore Harbor toxicity was due to PAHs and additional effects from the other contaminants at the site. So in summary, our technology that we're using with the biosensor allows us to look at pH concentration in minutes from small volume samples, and it allows measurements not possibly obtained with conventional methods where you need large volume samples. We have good correlation with GCMS when we do have large volume samples and can split them. We can use this to map concentration gradients in the water column and within sediments, and it's possible to identify sources and transport mechanisms using this technology. We also can use this to look at direct measurement of contaminated flux at the sediment-water interface by using seepage meters. We're also doing some research to look at using naturally occurring radionuclides coupled with the biosensor to also measure and calculate contaminated flux. Another advantage of this technology is we can prioritize samples for compound-specific GCMS analysis based on the total pHs measured by the biosensor. In assaying a distribution at a site, for instance, we don't have to collect samples and run non-detects. We know what the concentration or the total is going to be ahead of time. We can prioritize samples for compound-specific analysis for regulatory or particular compound fate determinations. The measurement of bioavailable or toxic fraction in sediments is possible, and with this technology, you could potentially use it to survey toxicity in the field. Future biosensor work that we have on the schedule is advection mechanisms driving pH transport in sediments at the Elizabeth River site. With our continuing SRP-funded work, we're going to continue that and look at using that to evaluate and guide remediation efforts in the future. We're hoping that this could be used at this site and other sites in the future. We're going to do some work looking at using the biosensor to detect oil-derived pHs to trace oil spill fate and toxicity. We're starting some of that work actually this week. Flux measurements, we're evaluating biosensor measurements versus passive sampling. We're going to look at the comparison of our seepage meter work with passive samplers in the field and also radium thorium measurements to calculate pH flux. We're doing that this summer at our Elizabeth River site. We're also looking at using the biosensor measurements to see how they are at predicting other toxicological endpoints besides amphipod toxicity. Things like cardiac abnormalities and inflammation, we're looking at doing that work with colleagues at other universities. And we're also working with Sapodyne Instruments look at developing the biosensor hardware further. The instrument we have now, we've used it in the field, it works. I would like to see the instrument smaller and more portable, and we're working with Sapodyne to look at doing that in the future. We're also looking at developing new antibodies. This technology could be particularly useful for PCBs, where new TMDLs are driving interest in limiting effluence of PCB concentrations. PCB congener-specific analysis is very expensive, so if we had a way to screen samples, do it in near real time, it'd be very helpful for that. We're also looking at the possibility of developing antibodies to certain HABs in Chesapeake Bay and how we could use that possibly in the future. With that, I'd like to acknowledge the NIEHS Superfund Research Program for their funding and allowing us to develop this technology further and using it to understand surface water, groundwater dynamics and how that affects bioavailability of contaminants at remediation sites. I'd like to thank all my colleagues at VIMS and in particular Steve Katari, who passed away a couple of years ago. Steve was instrumental in forging the collaboration between his lab and my lab to develop this technology. Joe Rieger and his colleagues at Elizabeth River Project have been very helpful. He's our collaborator on our grant. The folks at University of Maryland for our toxicology experiment collaboration. And of course, the folks at Sabine Instruments who've been involved in helping us develop the technology further as well. With that, I think we have some time for some questions.
Great. Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, we have. I have not seen any questions on the Q&A chat box. Folks are welcome to enter your questions into the Q&A chat box in the upper right-hand corner there. We can
and
also.
And Steve, there are a number of questions that have come in. Can you see the Q&A pod to the right? It's showing all questions.
Yeah,
I'm not seeing any questions listed.
Yeah, I'm not seeing the questions in the Q&A.
It's in the top right on that side above our chat. I can send them to you via chat if you don't see them.
Yeah, they're not showing up.
In the meantime, can I ask a question?
You may.
Okay. This is Louise White from Health Canada, and I've been working with, we're looking at pH and potency, and we're looking at some chemicals that are as potent or more potent than benzoylpyrene, and I'm just wondering when you're comparing your total pHs to GCEMS results, are you looking at just the 16 pH priority pollutants, or are you looking at a wider range of pHs, sort of like the way AL pyrene, to give an example of one that's much more?
Yes, we're looking at a wider range. I don't have the list in front of me, but we're also looking at some of the alkylated pHs because of our interest in their toxicity. So we are using a wider range, and we've looked at the antibody binding to a wide range of compounds. As long as it's within that 3 to 5 range. Of course, it varies for specific compounds. We may get less affinity for specific ones. But you got to remember, this isn't GCMS. It's giving us kind of a measure of the total.
Yeah, I just wanted to make, you know, I'm just saying sometimes or at some sites you didn't find a good correlation with, let's say, toxicity, and maybe it was you weren't measuring certain pHs.
I don't think this is a great tool to look at site-to-site comparisons, but generally within a site, we see a range of concentrations, and the distribution doesn't change that much within a site, if that makes sense.
Okay. Well, that's great. Thank you.
Yep.
Great. Thanks. We've got some other questions that are coming in to me via the chat. First one is, which cancer cell line or lines is used to create the hybridoma?
This was used, we used, I think it's a myeloma cell line.
Okay. And what is the linear range of your antibodies? And also there was a question about the method detection limit. Let's see. Anyway,
okay.
Method detection limit and upper limit for quantitation, excuse me.
Yeah. That's one of the issues with an antibody-based technique. You're limited by the physics of the antibody binding. So our range of quantitation is about 3 orders of magnitude. So as medical chemists, the good news is that it's on the sensitive side. So what we have to do with high concentration samples is dilute them to get back into the linear range of the response. For total 3 to 5 ring compounds, our detection limit around 0.1 or less in terms of a detection limit for the total.
And that was 0.1. What were the units on that?
Parts per billion.
You? Great. We have a couple more minutes until we are scheduled to start the next one, the next discussion. Any other questions coming from the phone line? Or Sarah, if you could forward on any questions via the chat, that would be helpful.
Yep, I was just sending you a few more.
Okay, great. In the meantime, I have a question on cost, just always something that we at EPA are considering. And I should have probably mentioned some of my background in terms of the Superfund program and our interest, obviously, in a lot of these field deployable analytical technologies. But cost is always something that we're considering in terms of per sample types of costs that we can then use. I noticed one of your conclusions was that we can use this to target more additional PAH analyses, GCMS type analyses that would be needed. So I'm always interested in what the general ballpark numbers for cost per sample.
Yeah, we're still working with the company to look at a more cost-effective instrument, but the cost of the instrument right now is probably equivalent to the instrument itself, a small GC. The analysis itself, we're looking at commercialization of the antibody, but the cost per sample once the instrument's in your hands is really just a few dollars per sample. So it's very cost effective after the initial investment in instrument technology. Again, it can pay for itself very rapidly if you can go in and basically map concentrations in a day and pick samples to save money on the more expensive GCMS analysis for specific compounds. It can be very cost effective. One of the applications we've used this for is actually to monitor in real time water concentrations during a dredging event to make sure that water column concentrations were below a target value of interest to engineers on shore, and we were able to monitor the concentrations during the dredging event across the river, report the concentration by cell phone, and they were able to continue the dredging project as concentrations were low enough and not in exceedance of the target value. So the cost savings there is beyond the analysis, but in terms of the actual implementation of the remediation efforts, so real-time cost savings.
Okay, thank you. We've got a few more minutes here, and I'm starting to see showing the open questions here. I think you responded to Eileen's question about have you looked at non-polar metabolites in TPH, which are recently of increased toxicological concern?
We've looked at basically alkylated.
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, we've looked at alkylated pHs and non-alkylated pHs. We haven't looked at a wide range of compounds that are on other people's interest lists. I think that, again, the real value of this technology is to look at the mass of pHs and using it to look at transport and fate. As far as toxicity issues, we'd have to look at some of those specific compounds of interest to see their affinity.
Great, thanks. Is the biosensor analysis sensitive to PAHs, which would be associated with colloidal solids that could go through or pass through a 0.45 micron filter?
We don't think so. We think that because of the fact that we're looking at essentially a biological molecule binding to the free pH, and that's some of the research that we've got planned for the near future, is to look at whether or not we can quantitate exactly if that free pH is what's binding the antibody. We feel that that's why it's probably a good predictor of toxicity in the pore water, because we're looking at the free pH and not that pH that's bound to colloidal material.
Okay. What there was a question on what GCMS methods are you comparing to, SWA-46, 8272, or ASTM D7 or D7363?
No, we're using our own inside method that we use at our lab that uses a larger range of pHs than like a standard EPA method. The basic technique is similar, but our hit list of compounds is longer than the 16 priority pollutants.
Okay, and what do you consider the advantages of this technique over real-time GCMS? In other words, the question was posed, why not just take a GCMS into the field? What is the advantage that we're deriving from this biosensor technique over just deploying real-time GCMS and with some of our field lab capabilities?
I think the real advantage here is the sample volume. I mean, the fact that we can look at pore water samples within sediments and look at the distribution, the 3D distribution, it's getting those samples, these low-volume samples, and the sensitivity that we have to look at just in 1 mL of water down to 0.1 part per billion is the real advantage with this technology. It's also fairly simple to do once you have the instrumentation and the antibody in hand.
Okay. We got just a few more minutes here. We can try to get a couple more questions in before we have to move to our next presenter. When you speak about toxicity, you mean primarily bioavailability. Relating this to our current understanding of toxicity of a given PAH as it's tested until now, is that correct? Am I correctly understanding that, this question?
Bob, could you repeat that, please?
When you talk about toxicity, you're primarily talking about bioavailability, or is there something else that you're getting at with the term when you talk about the toxicity of these?
In our case, we're looking at acute toxicity. So we're looking at the toxicity of the pHs in the pore water versus whole sediment toxicity, the experiments we've been doing so far. So I think that that's a measure of the bioavailability. As we're seeing that whole sediment pH concentrations are not a good predictor of the bioavailability or toxicity. Our metric in this case that I presented today is acute toxicity.
Great, thanks. Time for one more question. Let's see. There was a question on the relationship between GCMF. There was another question on, can the biosensor be used for water samples with suspended solids? I know you touched on that with the question about the 0.45 micron. Is there anything else? Does the sensor have the same response to PAHs in suspended solids than it might with different particle sizes? Have you looked at that?
We can't run high suspended loads through the instrument, so we're looking at filtered samples, but we feel that what we're looking at is the freely dissolved pHs with the antibody. So in the work that we've done looking at some filtered and unfiltered samples that don't have real high particulate loads, it can make a difference. So we really do think that we're looking at the freely available pH and or dissolved pH fraction. And as we know, that's a continuum. So it's probably that free form pH that's binding to the antibody.
Right. Great. Thank you. We've got to move on here. We're at 11:44, and I do see that we had a number of other questions. Perhaps one quickly, to commercialize the technology, your estimate of how much time that might take.
The instrument itself is available by talking to Sapodyne Instruments. I think they're ready and willing to make more instruments. As far as the antibody that we're using for this technology, we're in the process right now of looking at having that commercially available. I would hope that within the next month or two, we should have an answer to that question and understand the costs involved in that. Hopefully it's
great. So we're talking months.
Yeah.
Okay, great. One last question before we move on. There was a question about the correlation components, and in particular the y-intercept at 0.52 x. So I'm for a total pH.
Oh, yes. No, that's a good question. That's a good question. And what we're seeing is that that's an interesting question. And what we're typically seeing is higher measurements in the biosensor than we do by GCMS. And it depends on the sample, and that's a function of the quantitation limit of GCMS. That's one of the things that's attractive to me about the biosensor measurement is it's basically binding all 3 to 5 ring pHs. And these samples from the field are typically very complex, contain literally hundreds if not thousands of pHs. And what you see is if you blow up a total ion chromatogram from one of these samples is that our GCMS analysis is actually summing a subset of the total pHs, whereas the biosensor and the antibody is actually binding all the 3 to 5 ring pHs that are in a sample. So that's why you'll typically see a higher value on the biosensor than you will by GCMS. GCMS is only measuring a subset of what's really there.
Great. Well, appreciate your presentation. We have to move on to our next presenter, and I'll I'll note, Sarah, that we do have about five or six other questions that we were not able to get to. Several of those are related to the ability of this technology in the near future to look at, say, both PCBs and PAHs, some questions regarding availability of passive samplers, and some concentration or other techniques or strategies to try to deploy the technology. So we can try to follow up on those. But I would like to move. We're out of time. Thanks again for the presentation. I want to move to our next speaker. Is April with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. All right, April, let me find your information here. Okay. So next we'll be hearing the presentation on torts risk-based. Excuse me. Hang on 1 second. towards having some computer issues here at the moment. There it is. Towards risk-based environmental monitoring and technology assessment via toxigenomics technology and data science. So we'll be hearing from Dr. April Gu. She is currently an associate professor and director of graduate studies at Civil and Environmental Engineering Department, affiliated faculty and track leader for interdisciplinary bioengineering program within the College of Engineering, and affiliated faculty for the biotechnology program with Booth College of Health Sciences at Northeastern University in Boston. Dr. Gu received her BS in Environmental Engineering and Science from Tsinghua University in Beijing, China, and a PhD in Civil and Environmental Engineering jointly in Microbiology from the University of Washington. Her expertise and area of research interest include biotechnology for water and wastewater treatment and biological nutrient removal, risk-based water quality monitoring and toxicity assessment, biosensors and nanosensors, global phosphorus cycling and bioavailability of nutrients in natural ecological systems. And Dr. Gu has led and participated in over 30 research projects funded by various agencies, including National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, EPA, WRF, NIEHS, and others. She received the Soren Boost Outstanding Research Award from Northeastern University in 2011 and was elected to be a COE Faculty Fellow in 2014. And with that, I will turn it over to our next presenter, April.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction. And I would like to really thank you, NIEHS, and all the organizers for today's webinar to give me the opportunity to present this. And also thank you for all the audience taking time. And I would like to share with you today some initial technology development and some demonstration of application of a toxicogenomic-based technology and combined with the data processing tools for environmental monitoring as well as for water treatment technology assessment. So I think in the past decade, many of us in the field of environmental engineering, particularly in the water realm, are concerned with a large number of pollutants, including contaminants of emerging concern, particularly on the aspect I'm interested in is the unknown toxicity and risk associated with the large and the increasing number of contaminants. And what should we do about them in terms of safe and transport understanding, technology development, as well as regulation? And right now, I think TASCA has over 85,000 chemical registered, and most of them lacking comprehensive toxicological exposure data. And EPA right now having a series of programs, including ToxCast, and other programs are looking at the screening hundreds of chemicals of the toxicity effect. But particularly in water matrix, that's my most interest reside. There are certain unique aspects about mixture of contaminants in water. And we know that current both water and wastewater treatment technology are really targeted towards priority pollutants and the regulated limited number of pollutants. They are really not designed to effectively remove most of the trace contaminants. And they are widely spread, present most often in mixtures. And their harmful effects often exerted at very low concentrations. And especially on top of that, in both engineered and the natural systems, most of the contaminants have gone through either UV or photolight catalyst or other engineered processes that produce other transformation intermediates and metabolized products to make the mixture is even more complex. So the challenge is how can we have tools to evaluate and screen and understanding the toxicity of these large number of contaminants as well as their mixtures. And we also know at the same time I want to zoom in specifically looking at the technology efficacy assessment. We know that for both bioremediation and for water wastewater remediation technology are normally designed and optimized for targeted and regulated chemicals, and often they are they may not looking at the broad and the complex risks posed by the mixture contaminants as well as their transformation products, and therefore that lead to the need for tools helping us evaluating overall toxicity and risk reduction through the remediation process. So I think one of the reasons we're lacking really readily cost-effective and feasible tools allow us to do that in engineering or practical basis are partially reside in the fact that it's a status quo of the entire toxicology field, mostly rely on animal-based toxicity and assay. And we know that, of course, everything has to be balanced. In this particular case, it's balanced between the certainty and the cost. Using higher animal testing, we definitely gain on the certainty, but at expense is really resource intensive and a long turnaround time and a high cost, and which make it prohibitive for us to evaluate a larger number of environmental samples, particularly on a regular basis. And the effort required to really do that is daunting unless we do something different. And I think NRC, the TOX 21 vision, point out that one promising direction is to use combined and a tiered approach to incorporate in vitro high-throughput assays combined and in a tiered way with conventional animal-based assay to allow us to speed up and meet this daunting demand. And the vision calls for rely on more in vitro molecular and mechanistic-based in vitro assays, and with a further understanding of critical toxic pathways, advanced outcome pathway connections, as well as computational toxicology, system biology. I hope in the future that we can use this to help us prioritize our resources using high throughput as a screening, then lead to animal-based assay later on, and also eventually making progress towards predictive toxicology. And so along this line, here what presenting today is one of our attempts to develop a new toxic genomic-based assessment platform for toxicity evaluation screening and technology assessment. Specifically, we are talking towards the following four objectives. One is we try to explore developing a method applying real-time gene or protein expression profiling for toxicity assessment. We try to establish computation methods in parallel for quantifying the information and determining molecular toxicity endpoints, and then try to validate the method by correlating endpoints from our molecular assay with conventional phenotypic assays, and then at the end demonstrate the application of the assay for assessing water quality monitoring and exposure assessment in particularly water matrix. So today I won't have time to cover all of them, but I'll give some highlights of the results touching upon above four objectives. For those who are not very familiar with toxic genomics, I just give one quick slide, very cartoon simplified version. So basically when the environmental toxicant in exposure to an organism or to a cell, before we observe phenotypic level changes such as metabolic change, cellular structure change, growth and death, etc., actually at the molecular level, there are already transcription or translation level responses. So simply put, toxic genomics is the approach that we're looking at biological responses to toxicants, particularly at the sub-cytotoxic level. So before endotypical phenotypic effects are even being observed, and to look at the biological response at the molecular level and monitor changes, either gene promoter or protein or metabolites expression change patterns, and use that as a way for toxicity assessment. And so there are many toxicogenomics approach right now. There are protein-based protein omics, transcriptomics, metabolomics, et cetera. And our group explored the use of GFP fields, the recombinant cells. The reason we decided to use this particular platform is because with the GIP fused recombinant cells, it allows us to do real-time measurement of the cellular response, give us a temporal pattern, and also compared to other technology, it requires less complex protocol and less rigorous requirement of the protocol, make it more feasible for environmental application. So to simply put, we have GFT transformed the E. coli library over thousands of different strains, with each strain has one particular promoter indicating activity of a specific gene on a recombinant endoplasmid, and plasmid transformed in E. coli live cell. So when the cell exposed to toxicant and give out the GFP signal as indicator of the potential activation of that promoter. We also have an yeast strain-based, which has the GFP fused to protein and in the same open reading frame in a chromosome, which basically give us almost like equivalent to protein omic type of a reading. And then, so the assay is done on 384 wild plates. And so we've gone through a fluorometer to read the real-time, normally frequency at every 4 or 5 minutes a read. And we expose them to up to 1 to 3 hours. And then having the temporal individual gene or individual protein temporal response pattern, then go through the data analysis. So simply put, we are measuring changes in gene or protein expression patterns in exposure to chemicals or water samples in relative to control with no exposure. So I'm going to separate my results highlighting several parts. The first one, I want to show you some rationale for a particular assay we developed based on stress response pathway in sample and how we developed a particular dose response model based on our new interpoint indicator we proposed. So why a stress response pathway? We know that when the chemical in exposure to organism when exposed to the cellular level, it normally initiates at the beginning is through interactions and damages with the chemical or their derivatives with major macromolecules in the cell, such as protein, lipid, DNA, et cetera. And the cell have developed the systems to sensing some of the stress and the potential impact, and then initiate a receptor and have a signal transduction, then have a series of so-called cellular stress response with attempt to actually repair the potential stress and impact. If all those repair attempts fail to be effective, then eventually lead to cellular level effects, lead to dysfunction, apoptosis, all the others. And then also, if that continues, that will lead to organism level or higher level impact, then eventually lead to advanced outcome. And this whole concept is inconsistent with the adverse outcome pathway, so-called AOP concept. And we think that the cellular response, which is the stress response in the second box, are crucial in this whole pathway. And also a lot of stress responses, such as oxidative damage, DNA damage, and membrane damage, lipid, oxidation, et cetera, are known to be linked to certain toxicity mode of action. We do recognize this do not including all toxicity. There are a lot of like immunoassay, nuclear neuron toxicity, endocrine disrupting compounds, all they are would not be reflected in this particular assay we present today. So for the stress response pathway, we developed the assay based on the biomarkers we selected through both literature information as well as our own test as well as bioinformatic biomarker ranking analysis. So at the end, these are the categories. We have redox stress, detoxification. We combine them called the oxidative stress category. We have biomarkers involved in DNA damage sensing, damage repair. We call the DNA stress category. And we also have biomarkers indicating potential cell membrane damage, drug resistant efflux system. And we group them into so-called the membrane stress category and the protein stress, and also other on higher organs, we have receptor activation signaling biomarkers. So this is the principle and the rationale of the assay. So what this assay does, it gives us a simultaneous measurement of altered gene or protein expression pattern with a temporal resolution. So for every single gene over the exposure, 2 hour time, we'll have a temporal pattern. Then you put them in a heat map, and we'll have a two-dimensional overexposure time across all the genes or biomarkers. Then if you put that at a different, if you measure the altered gene expression level compared to the untreated control, so basically for each treatment, this assay would help us to obtain a 3D, we call the bioresponse spectrum as shown in the figure. So with time as one axis, biomarkers one axis, and the Z axis is altered expression level measurement. So we further looking at the three spectrum biospectrum we obtain for each treatment through the assay. One of the main goal for us is to really try to look at the pattern, play with different mathematical ways to process the data. The goal is to, can we develop a quantifier based on this three spectrum information that would allow us to give us some sort of measurement at either individual biomarker level or at the pathway level or at the entire ensemble or network level, to show a certain a response, particularly dose response pattern. So the particular index we propose is that the first one is TALE. It's called a transcriptional effect level index, and later on we use the same concept of proposed protein effect level index with the East library is the protein omics. And the common features of this index is that it would consider it the magnitude of the particular biomarker response. We would also incorporate the temporal pattern and accumulate effects over exposure time, and also try to quantify the extent of cellular pathway response. So with this particular index, we were able to now translate each assay into a gene-level or pathway-level quantifier, and that showed for all the chemicals we tested, or samples we tested, actually show a dose response pattern. So in addition to the dose response pattern, we could see with this particular index, we also combined with gene set enrichment analysis technique, and there are very limited tools out there for this analysis for specific time series taxonomic data. The tools are readily available for one-time or few-time reads, but for relatively high-resolution time series data, we actually have to modify and develop that. And also we took a special effort to consider when processing the data the fact that the toxicant-induced expression pattern are time, concentration, and chemical dependent. So in order to incorporate the temporal pattern effect, in addition to the TALE concept, we also explored different time series modeling and to consider a different dose concentration when try to interpret or review the mode of action. We also explored the common principle component analysis with different ranking matrix, et cetera. So I won't have time today to show more detail on this, but I will highlight some of the outcome. So this is one example to show how the toxicity impact and outcome and interpretation is very highly time-dependent. So the figure here shows the profile of the specific stress response category quantifier taken at three different exposure time at 30 minutes, 65 minutes, and 100 minutes. And this particular chemical here show is mitomycin, which is a model genotoxic and a DNA damager. And the results show that depending on at what exposure time you take the snapshot of the gene expression profiling exposure in a E. coli library, you may have a completely different profile and a different conclusion. So it shows that the mechanistic profile is quite a dynamic. So if you take the snapshot at 30 minutes, you may not identify the major DNA damage mechanism, but that mechanism is clear and dominating at 65 minutes. And if you can extend it to over 100 minutes exposure, the profile changes to completely different and dominated by protein, indicating more of a non-specific cellular depression or protein damaging effect as a dominating. So this indicating that it's especially for toxicogenomic assay, it's a critical, we need to look at the time temporal patterns. And this is another example to show how concentration are also crucial when you interpret the toxicity effect of a given chemical. This is an exercise we did using a common PCA component scoring ranking system to looking at the particular lead, and we look at the six different concentration exposure and try to look at the mechanism ranking of all the genes depending on different looking at each individual concentration separately or we put all the concentration results, all grouped together, do a combined PCA, and we can conclude a different dominating gene response pattern and also dominating response biomarkers. And so both TELLY and the PELLY, the indicator we proposed and derived, allow us actually to derive those response patterns for single individual chemicals, mixtures, as well as environmental water samples. Here is an example of a number of individual chemicals done by the yeast assay to show the dose response pattern. This particular figure shows the dose response pattern for all the biomarkers involved in DNA damage sensing and repair pathway. So with the dose response development at the molecular level, at the pathway level, it would now allow us actually to look the assay quantitatively. And so the second question we want to do is, do the molecular based assay endpoints actually meaningful? Means, can they anchor to phenotypic endpoints? So here we use the DNA damage repair pathway based PELLY as an example to show how they correlate with conventionally accepted DNA damaging assays. So we use the DNA damage AOP as an example. It is because the DNA damage repair are relatively conserved in terms of the infrastructure as well as a strategy cells use across all prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells, even though specific genes and the specific pathway may differ, but the common strategy and infrastructure share high similarity across different taxonomic levels. So it's more meaningful. So DNA damage can be done through many different molecular level interactions through single break, double break, oxidation, alkylation, etc. And then once the damage occurs and the cell senses certain damage, it would activate a certain DNA damage and the repair pathways. And if the repair fails, then eventually lead it to a serious number of different adverse outcomes. So based on this concept, we develop a DNA damaging pathway in sample bioassay. And this is the quick highlight of the results from one of the recent paper to show that of all the chemicals we analyzed with our assay, we developed the PELLY Geno, which is, stands for Genotoxicity Protein Effect Level Index, which is also derived on those response curves and the modeling. And we try to correlate that with the conventional COMET assay conducting human A549 cells by measuring TIL DNA percentage, and showed relatively really good correlation between our molecular assay and the COMET assay. And we also further compared our results across a number of positive and negative genotoxic chemicals with other conventionally wide accepted genotoxic assay, including Ames assay, COMET assay, micronucleus assay, as well as in vivo carcinogenesis assay in rats. And we also see a high level of consistency between the yeast-based assay we proposed with other assays. Actually, the highest correlation between our assay with the in vivo rats-based assay shows promising in this approach. So at last, I will give you quick examples of several applications of this assay for real water toxicity assessment, technology assessment, and water quality monitoring. So the first case study is through a tertiary treatment. This is in collaboration with Shane Snyder at University of Arizona. It's still unpublished. So Shane's group and the postdoc Aijia, they conducted a pilot field testing. They taken a secondary effluent and gone through a series in parallel tertiary treatment with different disinfection and oxidation treatment processes, including UV, ozone, amide, and chlorine, etc. And then they ship us the SP-enriched sample coming out from effluent of this pilot testing, and then we conducted a microtox and a toxigenomic assay in our lab. So I want to just share one highlight summary of the results, and this is a comparison of the fingerprinting across all the stress response profiling libraries of the blank control, the raw effluent sample from the secondary, and all the effluent from parallel pilot treated tertiary treatment gone through different oxidation and disinfection treatment processes. So a couple of key points, the pattern, the effluent toxicity pattern are highly technology dependent and also very consistent. As you can see, the treatment from ozone are mostly effective. Toxicity are both very low at both dose, 1.5 milligram and 6 milligram per liter. And the UV-treated ones also have a consistent pattern across all the UV-treated effluents. And when UV is combined with hydrogen peroxide treatment, certain categories of intermediates can be seen that were removed. However, certain category intermediates are still persistent, and they also remain as a consistent toxicity impact. So this shows that the assay can be applied for real water effluent monitoring, and it can differentiate different technology dependent effluent toxicity profile, can also give us insight on specific and particular group of contaminants or transformation process that can be induced through different technology, and how different treatment technology parameters such as dose concentration and parameter optimization can have an impact to eliminate or aggravate the effluent toxicity. The second case study is in a lab scale. We used the advanced oxidation electrofenton process to degrading a number of CECs. Here I show three examples of ibuprofen, triclosan, and bisphenol A. And on the y-axis on the right shows the toxicity profile at the time when the reaction goes through. At the 0 minute we start the assay, then as the reaction goes through, progress towards 15 minutes, 30 minutes, and 6 minutes, as we can see, the progressive temporal-dependent toxicity reduction and the profile changes as a result of the removal of the parent compound, but however, production of the intermediate products. I didn't show here, but in detailed in the paper published, we also did a LC mass and a GC mass analysis of targeted intermediate products through the transformation and map out the potential correlation and causal intermediate compounds that lead into the toxicity we see at a different time point. So with this kind of data, we can looking at the toxicity profile as a certain degradation or remediation technology being applied to a certain given water matrix over time. And we can look at the efficacy of reducing certain toxicity category and the reduction of toxicity overall, and try to use that as a guidance to lead to better optimization of the treatment technology and the parameters with the goal of minimize the effluent toxicity overall rather than only looking at the parent chemical as we currently do most of the time. Some of the chemicals were pretty clear that even though their parent compound actually disappeared within 10 minutes, so if you only measure the parent compound as your target, as a way to measure the efficacy, you may conclude that by 10 minutes, your parent compound almost 95% removal all done. But if you look at the toxicity profile, actually very often at that time, the toxicity is the highest in effluent as the overall mixture. Only after a certain time, the overall toxicity reduction start to really taper down. And so that's valuable for technology development and optimization. And the last example I want to show really quickly is a case study. We used the assay to look at the Dan River spill, which occurred in February 2014, one of the largest national coal ash spill. Over 39,000 tons of coal ash were spilled into the Dan River. And so for this particular study, we collaborated with Madeline Schreiber from Virginia and Brian William from Dan River Association. And so we obtained through their kind help both surface water samples and sediment samples, and we obtained the samples after the spill over a time period, over a year period, had a three sampling event over 12 different locations, upstream of a spill, downstream of the spill. And for all the samples, we did a parallel chemical analysis to measure, in addition to typical pH, temperature, all that, we measured the total organic compound, the dissolved organic matter with the fluorescence scattered spectrum, and the trace element of all the metals, and we also conducted toxicity assay with both the yeast cell as well as the human cells. So the the results are unpublished, but I can summarize some of the key observations we have so far. So the toxicity assay in parallel with the chemical analysis as well as iceberg experiment means that we artificially made a mixture of all the metals we detected at a different location at a different time and made artificial mixture of the detected components in the lab and measured the fingerprint toxicity and then did a correlation and comparison with the original analysis from the original surface water and sample. So using that approach, we were able to obtain temporal and spatial trends for metals and molecular toxicity over time and over space. And that gave us insights of toxicity profile in the water and sediment after the spill as the progress a long time, as well as from the upstream of the spill downstream in the river. And through statistical correlation, we can also obtain insights and conclusions on how much the toxicity we really observe actually can be contributed to the mixture of the metals we could detect in the water and the sediment. And we also, through the correlation, concluded that the organic matters in this case was not contributing to the dominating toxicity effect, but the metals indeed contributed to the dominating toxicity we observed. So to conclude, I think a quantitative toxicogenomics-enabled assessment platform has been explored and developed, although preliminary we're still do more testing with real case studies, and that allow us to gain the fundamental quantitative understanding of molecular perturbation and how potentially they can correlate with the phenotypic toxicity endpoints. And we have demonstrated that the technology potentially applicable to exposure assessment, to water quality monitoring, as well as for technology efficacy evaluation and assessment. And I would like to thank all the collaborators and well as the postdoc, PhD student, and the students who contributed to the information I presented today, as well as all the funding sources from NIHSRP, NSF, and CDM Howard Scholarship. Thank you very much again for your attention.
Thanks so much, April. We've got about 2 minutes here. We need to move on to our next set of speakers in 2 minutes. And there was one question, and perhaps it's a question more put out to the group at large. But with respect to public participation and associated educational elements, the dose response model is fairly simple to explain and comprehensible to the general public because it relates directly to common experience, you know, something like alcohol ingestion, for example. In contrast, the toxicogenomics approach is much more complex. Have public participation materials been developed? In other words, how are you communicating these types of approaches to, or are you developing public materials to convey these types of approaches to the general public?
So far we have, of course, we have the papers, published journal papers that describe the detailed, you know, steps and the rationale, how we derive this approach and derive molecular level dose response. So you mean that can we prepare some material to make it more accessible to general public to perceive understanding this rationale, right? Is that your question?
Yeah, I believe that's the question.
No, we haven't done anything beyond the just journal publications and the workshops and the meeting conference presentations.
Great. Well, I kind of put that out there as, again, a question to the group at large, or at least folks that are working on these toxicogenomic approaches, that probably some additional materials will need to be put together for outreach materials to get the public to understand these approaches versus some of the existing models or approaches that we have. So thank you, April. Again, I'll note that if folks have additional questions, you can continue to type those for any of our speakers into the chat box. If we can get to them at the end of our next discussion, we will do so and take as many of them as we can. And also, any questions that don't get answered here will be forwarded on to the presenters, and hopefully they will respond to the individual question. The folks that pose those questions. So with that, thanks, April, and I'd like to move on to our third and final presentation on biomarkers of exposure to hazardous substances. We'll be hearing next from Dr. Natalia Vasileva and Dr. Brogdon Barnich from the University of California, Davis, UC Davis. Dr. Vasileva is a SRP trainee and a postdoctoral scientist in Bruce Hammack's lab at UC Davis. She is an expert in the development of immuno-based analytical methods for environmental and human health monitoring. She's also exploring ways to use nanobodies as versatile tools for disease diagnostics and therapeutics. Dr. Vasileva obtained her PhD from INSA de Lyon in France with research on implantable microelectrode biosensors for neurochemical monitoring of brain function. Wow, very interesting. And Dr. Barnich is a postdoctoral scientist in Bruce Hammack's lab, again at UC Davis. And Dr. Barnich completed his PhD in organic chemistry at Claude Bernard University in Lyon, France. He's an experienced scientist with a strong background in synthetic chemistry, ranging from small compounds such as toxins, catalysts, and bioreagents to multi-step total synthesis of natural products. And with that, I will turn it over to Natalia and Bogdan. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me as well?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. So my name is Bogdan Barnich, and thank you very much for a kind presentation. And together with Natalia Vasileva, today we are going to talk about some of the research that has been done in our laboratory as a part of UC Davis Contract Research Program. Superfund program, sorry. On the second slide, you can see the brief outline of our today's talk that is that will start with presentation of the general principle of the immunoassay, and then we'll talk about the position of immunoassay among other analytical tools. This will follow by criteria, how we actually like choosing target analytes and what are actually good target analytes. And after that, we'll briefly talk about new reagents that are nanobodies. And finally, we'll finish our presentation by the we'll talk about the projects in which and how our immunoassay center is interacting with other other centers and also non-Superfund partners. So here you can see the very simplified scheme of the ELISA method. So as Professor Michael already told a little bit some background about immunoassay, so I will just very quickly go through how we are actually like performing the immunoassay analysis. So on the first step, we call the plate with 14 antigens that has the heptan attached to it, and after that we add analyte to the well and antibody. So antibody has a choice to either to bind the analyte molecule or heptan that is connected to the quoting antigen that is on the plate. So fine, after that, we wash out the free antibodies or antibodies that are bound to free analyte in the solution. And the antibodies that are bound to the heptan stay attached to the surface. So after that, we measure the amount of antibodies that are on the surface by addition secondary antibody that recognize the primary antibody and has the reporter that give us the readout. So as you can see from this scheme, the more analyte we have, the less strong the signal we get. So now when we know like the general how the immunoassay works in general, but what are the advantages and disadvantages of this method? So there are so many like very powerful analytical techniques like GCMS and HPLC-MS, and you, as Dr. Michael told before, that very often like when we do immunoassay, we compare it to other methods like as very often like the method of standard RGC or HPLC-MS based methods. But how we actually choose how we choose the analyte and what are the good analyte for ELISA? So first of all, I should say that analytes with average polarity are very easy targets for immunoassay. However, this is not due to poor affinity of antibodies towards very polar or non-polar targets, but more due to solubility issues or other factors. So as Dr. Michael also showed, that the immunostate or immunostate-based methods can be developed for like very unpolar compounds like EHs. Another criteria in the decision-making tree is the flexibility of the analyte. So generally, it is very easy to generate antibodies against more rigid structures than the flexible ones. And therefore, compounds containing rings or aromatic rings or conjugated systems usually are considered more easy targets for analytes. And it should be noted that most of the pesticides and environmental contaminants contain aromatic rings or other cycles and are considered actually easy targets for ELISA. The last thing, and actually there was a question about it previously, that very often we say that ELISA is much cheaper method compared to GC and LC-MS-based methods. However, we should remember that development of new ELISA requires requires the startup time and startup cost, and therefore it becomes actually really economically interesting only when the relatively large set of samples have to be analyzed. And again, this is usually the case in the environmental contamination screenings and exposure studies. So let's go to the next slide. And so here, I just want to give you a better feel of how we choose the analyte and what is actually the good analyte for ELISA. So first of all, I want, so the compounds that are presented here are all the compounds that we have developed immunostates for. And on the very, on the top right corner of the left corner of the screen, you can see the bisphenol A. So bisphenol A is commonly found in diverse types of plastics, and since it possesses some estrogen-like properties, its heavy use raises safety concerns. Flame retardants that are on the over here, like tetrabrom bisphenol A and BDEs, has also raised health concerns because of their reported effects on endocrine system, liver, and tends to deaccumulate in the case of BDEs. So pyrophos, for example, is also very very toxic pesticide, and it's still actually in use. The other examples are the hydroxyfipronil and 3-phenoxybenzoic acid. So actually, those compounds that they are not pesticides, they are metabolites of pesticides, which is fipronil itself and pyrethroid. And you can also see the triclosan, the active ingredient of lots of soaps and other domestic products, and also the toxin that is found in lots of molds is the cytotoxin B1. So as you can see, all these compounds contain rings, and more precisely, they contain aromatic rings, and they are pretty rigid, and it was pretty easy to develop the immunostate for those compounds. And the other thing I want to say that in all these cases, the requirement for analysis of large set of samples was also met, since most of these compounds are used in large quantities and they can be easily found in household, humans, and the environment. So now I would like to say a few words about the relatively new technology that is used in our laboratory. So as you all know, immunoanalytical tools heavily rely on antibodies. And historically, monoclonal antibodies technology succeeded polyclonal antibodies because it offered some advantages, such as the last batch-to-batch variability, and can be produced in almost infinite quantities. More recently, in 1991, another type of antibodies was discovered in families. So those antibodies, as you can see here, are devoid of light chain so they are only heavy chain antibodies. And it is possible to express only the heavy or heavy chain part of these heavy chain antibodies. And the resulting protein is only 15 kilodaltons in size. So it's very small. It's very stable and very well soluble in water. The thing is like this small protein is still remain the recognition properties of the parent antibody and offers lots of advantages compared to other technologies like polyclonal or monoclonal antibodies. So the single domain nature of VHH makes them highly amenable to genetic manipulation and easy to produce in various expression systems. So for example, VHHs can be produced in bacterial cell cultures like E. coli. And we know that bacteria divide much faster than mammalian cells, and therefore VHHs can be produced in much larger quantities in a day, and it's easier, much easier to produce than monoclonal antibodies, for example. And the other advantage is that VHHs are easy to manipulate genetically, so we can make perform the mutagenesis, or we can introduce specific labels, or we can add like tags, whatever we want. The storage of VHH is also more reliable than monoclonal antibodies. So very often monoclonal antibodies are stored as a cell line in frozen liquid nitrogen, while VHHs can be stored as a plasmid DNA, frozen bacterial cell culture, or as genetic as the genetic code. And finally, what I want to say is that it is very well, very thermally stable, so it is more amenable for like field portable assays because we don't need to or using in underdeveloped countries where the control of temperature is not always possible. And the last thing that I would like to say here is that. It can actually, once published, it can be reproduced, the nanobody specific for target can be reproduced in any laboratory for under $100. That's why I think there is like lots of, and you can see lots of advantages of nanobodies versus other antibodies like polyclonal or monoclonal antibodies. And we have successfully used this technology for developing immunoassays or immunoassay-based sensors for different targets. And Natalia will talk more about that. At this point, I would like to give the word to Natalia.
Thank you, Bogdan. And hello, everybody. So I would like to talk about how we collaborate with other scientists, how we use their knowledge and expertise to improve our work, and in turn, how we provide and apply our reagents and immunoassay. So here on this slide, I identified steps in the immunoassay development where we usually have interactions with other groups. The first important step is the identification of the target analyte. So these could be new chemicals that have recently been identified for certain use, or the old chemicals that were considered safe and the result of the heavy use accumulated in the environment to the levels that now raise concerns. To do this identification efficiently, we collaborate with Professor Thomas Young, a researcher from Superfund Center at UC Davis. So his lab performs a non-targeted analysis using high resolution mass spectrometry. So they take an environmental sample and perform a full scan, full mass scan, and then fragment of the ions. So these HRMS data are compared with mass and fragment libraries containing thousands of known compounds. So in this way, they identify the pollutants that are present in high concentration in that particular sample. Then they inform us on the identified compounds that, and then we develop an immune assay to this target analyte. Then the immune assay allows sensitive and high throughput analysis of different environmental samples from different sources. And such screening allows identification of new locations where concentration of the target analyte is elevated. Screening. And then in turn, we inform Tom Young's lab, and they again analyze the sample from a new source, aiming to identify another marker of environmental contamination. So the examples of such collaboration were identification of pyrethroid pesticide, fibrinol insecticide, and its metabolite, and triclosan. So to give you some background, triclosan is a widely used and antimicrobial agent, commonly found in soap, shampoos, toothpaste, and many other household products. And the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey reported that triclosan was detected in the urine of nearly 75% of people tested. And over 50% of rivers surveyed in the United States contained triclosan. On the other hand, at UC San Diego, Dr. Tukey's lab showed that triclosan causes liver cell proliferation, fibrosis, and oxidative stress. So repeated exposure to triclosan and continued liver fibrosis eventually promote tumor formation. So with the collaborative effort of Superfund researchers, including Tom Young and our lab, as well as Dr. Tukey and others, triclosan has been banned in the United States last year. So triclosan was also in the center of another collaboration that we had also with Superfund program at UC San Diego with Dr. Pizzoli and Dr. Anaya. Well, as reported by the World Health Organization, the leading cause of mortality in Mexico is cardiovascular disease. And within Mexico, higher mortality is observed on the U.S.-Mexico border compared to the rest of Mexico. So the purpose of the Los Laureles Canyon Dust pilot study was to evaluate the exposure risk of the population at the U.S.-Mexico border, and particularly in the San Diego-Tijuana city region. So for this purpose, household dust, urine, and demographic data were collected from 46 residents, and public health survey was also conducted. And then these samples were then analyzed. And among them was the triclosan, among the contaminants. And so our lab at UC Davis performed analysis using immune assay and GC-MS. And our data showed that the U.S.-Mexican population at the border was a significant health risk, since the mean concentration of triclosan in the urine samples we found was indeed high. Well, the immune reagents we develop for plant-based assays, we also apply in different formats. And our favorite are different biosensor formats like lateral flow strips. However, we also provide the reagents to the collaborators. So together with UC Davis Superfund partners, we develop microfluidic devices with Dr. Pan and optical biosensors with Dr. Kennedy. So here is an example of a microfluidic device. So this device possesses different chambers with with electrodes at the bottom. And each chamber is loaded with an electrolyte and one of the reagents. These are antibodies, analytes, buffers, or enzymatic substrates. So using the power from a mobile phone, electrodes can apply a certain potential that leads to electrolysis of the electrolyte and generation of the bubbles. So bubbles in turn push the reagents into the reaction chamber or the buffer towards the reaction chamber. And so I'm conducting an immune assay on the chip. And here is an example of the calibration curve obtained with the classical plate-based ELISA and a lab on a chip format for the BD47 analyte. So you can see that the performance of the chip-based ELISA is very much comparable to the conventional format. However, the sensor format provides a number of advantages, like rapid detection time, usually than 15 minutes, field portable autonomous format, but also it requires only a small amount of reagents and the sample. So here is another example. Together with Dr. Kennedy's lab, we developed a number of nanoparticle-based sensors. So here is one, the most recent example. So the group developed an immuno platform on the surface of a photonic crystal. And due to the particular physical properties, the photonic crystals have an advantage of enhancing the excitation of the fluorophores and extracting the emitted signal, leading to a high signal-to-noise ratio. So here is an example of the assay in sandwich format, where a primary antibody is coated on the nanoparticles. Then the analyte is captured, and a secondary antibody labeled with a fluorophore serves as a reporting molecule. So here, nanoparticles bring further improvement by providing well-controlled surface coverage with antibodies, and further enhancing fluorescent excitation and extraction of the signal. So these overall enhancements translated to ultra-sensitive detection of the analyte at ultramolar concentration, and dramatic increase in sensitivity compared to classical ELISA. As you can see, it's a six-fold increase in sensitivity. And this extraordinary technology led to a small spin-off company, Tsunamitech, that is also located in Davis. And so in addition to scientific advances, we also provide training to international scholars on immunoassays and novel reagents like nanobodies. And we provide reagents and research support to academic and private laboratories. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention and interest. And we would like to acknowledge support from UC Davis Superfund Research Program and Superfund community, as well as our Contract Center. And we invite you to explore our lab website indicated on the slide. And if you would like to have more information or request any reagents, we will be happy to discuss the opportunities. And you're very welcome to contact me or Bogdan. And we are happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much for your presentation, Natalia and Bogdan. If there are any questions, we can open the phone lines. And also, I will keep an eye on the text questions as well. Give it just a minute or two. And then, Sarah, let me know if we have additional time.
I'm sorry. We don't really hear you.
Hello?
Yes. You appear and disappear.
Sorry, again, thank you for the presentation. If we have questions, keep an eye on the chat. I don't see anything that's come in so far. And I just wanted to put out to Sarah that if we have some additional time, perhaps we can go back. We have four or five questions from the other two presenters. We might be able to do that. So, and I'll open the phone lines and look for questions for the UC Davis folks as well before we open it up to the broader seminar. Thanks. Okay, so we are opening the phone lines to see if any of the folks on the phones have questions for our last two presenters, Dr. Natalia Vasileva and Dr. Bogdan Barnich from UC Davis. Okay, looks like we're getting a couple here to come through. Okay, this question is for Bogdan. Are the nanobody ABS as sensitive as traditional monoclonal ABS?
Yes. So if you can, I mean, so the thing is that we are not, the success rate is probably not as high with, at that point as with monoclonal antibodies. So with, if it's monoclonal antibodies, probably you can get 80% success rate. The nanobodies, we have like 40% success rate. So sometimes we immunize and we can get the VHH. But if you get VHH, very often the sensitivity is very comparable to monoclonal or polyclonal antibody based assays. So it goes to PBD levels or below. We had, I think the lowest that we have is nanobodies was 0.5 nanomole, nanogram per milliliter, the IC50 of the assay. So, and so it means that the sensitivity is even like less, 0.1, for example.
Okay, thanks. We've got another one here. Given the improved nanobody stability, how long can the sensors last? And I noticed this jumped out at me as something that's been traditionally a challenge for ELISA type analysis, that we had to keep stuff at certain temperatures and that there were certain lifespans that those things lasted. But given the improved nanobody stability that you see here, is there any comments you can make about the longevity of the sensors?
Mm-hmm. So we didn't try you know, like making sensor enough that like leaving it for a year or two and try it later. But what we did, we exposed the nanobodies before use. We exposed nanobodies to heat, and I think with one of them we were able to have fully, to not lose any sensitivity after heating the nanobody solution to 80 degrees for 1 hour. Sometimes, you know, it depends. Actually, the stability of nanobody depends on the number of cysteines in it. So if you have like two cysteines and you have this, you know, cysteine breach, usually it increases the melting temperature of the nanobody, but decreases the overall stability toward the heat. And there was a couple of papers showing that degradation is due to the intermolecular reaction with cysteine.
Okay, great. We're coming to an end here. I think we have one more here. One study left the nanobody at room temperature for 2 months and observed heightened stability. Hang on, I'm trying to get this whole question here. In this case, the nanobody was fused to an enzyme reporter. So that, I guess somebody's noting that there's a study that left the nanobody at room temperature for 2 months and observed heightened stability. In this case, the nanobody was fused to an enzyme reporter. So I guess that's one list of a study that looked at the longevity of these four thermally stable antibodies. So with that, we're at 12:50. We have just a couple minutes left here. Sarah, feel free to jump in and tell me if we have a few more minutes to try to answer some additional questions or if we should begin with the wrap-up. Please let me know.
Yep, you can go ahead and ask a few more questions.
All right. I don't see any more for our last two presenters, but we did have a few, and let me see if I can go back to some of those questions here from our first two presentations. Looking for some open questions here.
So, Stephen, this is April.
Yes.
I wonder if it would be proper for me just to add one regarding the question you asked me earlier about the public material related to the toxic genomic data information processing. I forgot to mention that we are being funded at the moment by MathWorks Act to develop a MathWorks-based toolbox for time series toxic genomic data process analysis data visualization toolbox that will be made available to all public.
Mm-hmm.
Great, thanks for that. And I think we have a couple questions here that relate to your presentation, April. Do you plan to use the approach that you talked about in your section, do you plan to use that approach to conduct widespread screening of unregulated chemicals? And if so, have you identified any surprising toxicants?
Is that a question
that
for me?
For yes, okay. April, for you.
Yes, yes, we are currently using the assay to screening a large number of unregulated chemicals. that have been surprising, especially some chemicals being reported previously mostly as EDC or endocrine disrupting chemicals, but we actually found other toxic effects of those chemicals. Because of the screening, we have a manuscript in draft called the screening of unregulated chemicals and classification based on toxicity profile, and that's not published. So I probably should not mention specific chemicals yet, but they are in the pipeline.
Well, I imagine there's a few folks chomping at the bit to hear what that list of chemicals might be, so keep us posted on when that information will be available. April, I have one other question from your presentation as well. Were you surprised that the chlorine-treated treatment plant effluent showed much lower toxicity than effluent treated with chloramine?
Actually, I was not not really, because there are more literature showing that you use chloramine, even though chloramine is supposed to reduce the to reduce a certain the DBP products, but there are more recent evidence, including Shane Snyder's group and other people's work, showing that the chloramine actually tends to produce nitrile-containing compounds. They actually tend to have a genotoxicity effect. What I was really surprised actually to see UV-treated effluent show the kind of consistent toxicity patterns means that there is something produced by UV technology-dependent transformation products in that process. To me, that was a bit surprising.
Great, thank you for that. Let's see, we got about 2 minutes left if we can try to answer one more question for some of our presenters. I'll see if I can. There was some agreement to the comment made regarding public materials and outreach materials, trying to explain the toxic genomic approach versus some of our current approaches. I think there was some agreement with some of the commenters as regards to that. For our first presenter, I don't know, Michael, if you're still on with us, but there was a question regarding whether or not you've tested passive samplers for your PAH technologies. That might actually concentrate a sample. Have you used passive samplers? I think you mentioned some flux samplers, but you had a question specifically on passive samplers and whether or not you've looked at those.
Yeah, it's a good question. That's actually planned for this summer. What we're planning to do is where we have these concentration gradients within the sediment, we're going to deploy passive samplers, look at biosensor measurements of discrete water samples, and also look at outflow from the sea. So we're going to compare and also radium-thorium detection to look at contaminant flux. So we're going to compare all three methods together this summer.
Great. Sounds interesting, and we look forward to seeing the results of that. Sarah, anything else before I read some closing comments here? We've got about 5 minutes left, and I think we were due to start that process here with about 5 minutes left in our time. So. Unless I hear some objections, I will move, and you can show those slides. but just before we conclude, I want to thank everyone for your participation. I really want to thank our presenters as well, but just want to make some notes here with regards to some additional materials that you guys can have access to. So I wanted to make sure that folks are aware of the related URLs. You can check the pod on your CLUIN webinar here to look for some of those seminar resources and seminar feedback links if you have additional resources or feedback you'd like to provide us. This seminar will stay indefinitely so that you can access it for future after the presentation. There will be audio as well as slide materials presented for that. I'd also like to remind participants of the various ways that you can stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any other CLUIN webinars of interest. And so you can go to the CLUIN.org website, the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page. There's a group there. You can follow the EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter. You can join the CLUIN LinkedIn group. That's a LinkedIn group for members of the Cleanup Information Network that provides a lot of information. We do a lot of webinars, not only for the folks at Superfund Basic Research, but a whole variety of types of EPA programs are supported through CLUIN and that group. And you can also follow SRP, NIEHS on Twitter, of course. They have some information there. And then I mentioned this at the top of our discussion today, but this is actually part of a series. So I'd like to encourage everyone to come back and join us on May 22nd at 1 p.m. Eastern for the second session of this series. And this is on techniques for trace analysis of metal and chemical metabolites. In this, the second installment of our sessions here on analytical technologies, the speakers will highlight techniques that help measure trace levels of metals and chemical metabolites, better understand environmentally relevant chemical exposures. And we will have speakers Dr. Tracy Punshin from Dartmouth College, Dr. Bruce Buchhold from Lawrence Livermore Lab, and Dr. Lee Ferguson from Duke University. So look forward to that again on May 22nd, I believe that was. Let me double check that. Yes, May 22nd, 1 p.m. Eastern time will be that second installment of the analytical series. And then again, we have a third session as part of this, and we'd love for you to join us there as well, just noting that that final session, that third and final session for the analytical series here will take place on June 12th at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And this session will focus, or we'll have speakers who focus on highlighting tools and methods to detect contaminants, including PCBs, perfluoro and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFOSs, which have been quite a bit in the news for us lately. We'll also be talking about the chlorinated volatile organic contaminants and measuring their fate and transport in the environment. And those speakers for the third session will include Dr. Carrie Hornbuckle from the University of Iowa, Jennifer Guelfo from Brown University, and Mark Brusso from the University of Arizona. So we are right up against our time here, 3 p.m. Eastern. I'd like to go ahead and conclude this webinar. Again, I want to thank all of our participants and certainly all of our speakers today. Dr. Mike Unger, who presented on field-ready biosensor, or excuse me, who presented on the PAH tools. Dr. April Gu, who talked about the toxigenomics components. And then, of course, our last two presenters from UC Davis, Natalia and Barney. So with that, we conclude our seminar for today and hope to see all of you folks back for installments 2 and 3 of this great session. Thanks so much, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.